Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, a budget to begin the work of preparing for a new economy post-COVID. But what sort of economy was the Chancellor referring to? One of greater investment, falling public debt, low taxes and higher pay for all? Or a new economy of big state with high taxes, poor growth, and falling living standards? We got a lot about Prosecco, some bigging up of Brexit. There was something in there about red flags, I remember, and Rishi tried to make a joke about beer barrel politics, or some such thing. Was there anything else, though? Don't forget you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, it was any wonder that the Chancellor had anything left to say? So much had been leaked before the budget, not to mention that many of the big things that will impact our finances we already knew about: national insurance hike, pensions triple lock suspension, and the income tax bans, CGT, IHT levels all frozen. Before we get though to what was actually in there, what was left, what he did say, an assessment, gentlemen, if you would. Rishi's performance and the budget generally, the tone, if you like. Simon?
The tone? Well, I mean, he did it in the middle of half term, which I thought was controversial for any of us financial journalists with children. And I know that we don't run the country for financial journalists with children, but it was annoying. But I think it's maybe because he wanted to have it far enough away from Guy Fawkes Night, because at the end of that speech, he went pinging off like a firework. Doom, 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 doom. He really had some pep about him, didn't he? But I thought that he was very upbeat, and I think fair play to Rishi. He deserved a chance to be upbeat, didn't he? Because although it seems like we've had an endless stream of budgets in recent times, they've all been sort of emergency type ones. Even if you think back to last March, when it was abundantly clear that the economy was doing better than we expected in the lockdown scenario, we had already had the roadmap published for getting out of lockdown. The vaccine rollout was gathering pace and was already shifting on. We were doing very well. We had that vaccine optimism kind of thing. So although we were technically in lockdown, it was definitely a bit more of an upbeat mood about it come last March. But this time round, what he's got is he's got a scenario where the tax that we've got coming in looks better than we thought. The borrowing looks not as bad as we thought. The economy's bouncing back, and they're doing this leveling up stuff, chucking money at various things. And so he had a bit of a bounce to him. We're not out of the woods yet, but you could see how what he was trying to go for was the right, we're on track for recovery now kind of thing. The only thing I would say to that, and I think we're going to go into the economy in a moment, is that actually, if you look at the GDP forecasts from the OBR, I mean, it's kind of red hot this year, pretty hot next year, and then it goes back to not particularly great growth. I mean, the roaring 20s that we were going to have, they're not showing through in the GDP forecasts. And the only other thing I'd say is, I mean, it's been dubbed a number of different budgets, the Prosecco budget, you know, various things like that. To me, that was the inflation budget. In the budget, official budget report that, you know, the Chancellor put out, there were 53 mentions of the word inflation.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of inflation being mentioned. To my mind, inflation, yeah. Budget.
We're going to talk about that in more detail and the impact that's going to have on our personal finances. But Lee, the tone. Did you read the whole budget?
Georgie, yeah, that's the classic thing, opening up that PDF. The first thing I do is I look at all the key terms, savings, savers, pensions, see what it jumps to, see if there's any sort of devil in the detail type thing. But in terms of the budget yesterday, it was obviously a bit of a spring in the step of Mr. Sunak, I would say. Maybe he'd had a couple of Sprites and a Twix before he left. We saw those photographs, all these glossy photographs of him, you know, preparing the budget. There's a picture of his dog asleep with him and in his socks and sliders that cost £90, which is not a fashion choice that I would make. But, you know, he wanted to show, I guess, a little bit that he's down with the kids. And the thing is with Rishi Sunak, actually, as a Chancellor, I think he's quite a measured person, as in when he's talking, I think he's a very good public speaker. I found sometimes Philip Hammond's dad jokes just a little bit too much, and that became a bit of a circus. A lot of, you know, stopping and starting and heckling and all of that kind of thing. And then with George Osborne, it just was a kind of, he would just ping out all sorts of rabbits out of the hat. And that was a personal finance journalist kind of dream. But yesterday, there wasn't an awful lot, I would say, that was personal finance measures, as in, you know, little rabbits in the hat and that kind of stuff. There was a couple of things which we'll obviously mention in the course of this podcast, but it felt relatively kind of measured in that kind of way that I was listening to what he was saying, but there were parts where I was just completely losing the will. For example, when he was talking about overhauling the taxes on alcohol, which felt like went on, it felt like it just went on and on and on. And yes, we're, you know, us Britons on the whole do like a, you know, a good tipple, but I don't know if it was worthy of that kind of length in that speech. And actually the first thing I thought as he was finishing that up was, what bad stuff is there around? Because it just felt like he was really, really hammering it home on that point. So yeah, I mean, today since the budget, the aftermath is what the cost is going to be for people and what take home pay and everything next year, and a lot of the measures we already kind of knew anyway. And over the course of last weekend, I was logging into my work emails because I was getting so many emails from the Treasury at obscure times with all sorts of measures that were coming out. And of course, Mr. Sunak was also told off yesterday for doing that. And he was told off about that in March as well. So will things change in the next budget?
So I thought the point of leaking this sort of business was so that nothing got buried on the day, you know, if it was good news. But actually, to be honest, I think they could have done with a bit more of it in the budget. I felt it was really lightweight. I kept just thinking, well, oh yeah, and how are you going to do that? Especially with some of the levelling up stuff. But Simon, I want to delve a bit more into the economy. You mentioned there about OBR and growth figures. They pore over this, and we get the results pretty much immediately afterwards. But the IFS as well, they've been looking at it. They've been talking about living standards going down. Their assessments of where our economy is heading, because the way that the Chancellor was talking, heck, we are in a great position. COVID, what COVID? Apart from the fact that Keir Starmer wasn't there because he got COVID, and when most of the front bench had their masks on. But this is the budget for post-COVID.
It is, yes. And just to go back to those figures that we were talking about there in terms of GDP, the not quite so roaring 20s as we thought. This year, 6.5% GDP growth. That's pretty bumper. Next year, 6% GDP growth. Again, that's seriously bumper. But then it drops down to 2.1, 1.3, 1.6, 1.7. Not bad, better than actually we had for many years after the kind of financial crisis and recession there, but not anything really to write home about. Inflation is the concern, as I said. Now, that is forecast to come in this year at 2.3%. It's actually higher than that right now, 3.1. But you got to remember that's kind of like averaging out over the whole year. 4% on average next year and rising as high as 4.4% before coming back down, 2.6% in 2023, 2.1% in 2024, and then back to target 2025, 2%, and then 2% in 2026. Now, in all reality, if that inflation spike next year is as temporary as the Treasury thinks it's going to be, as the OBR forecasts that it's going to be, then that's not so much of an issue. It has illustrated quite how swiftly it swept in, if you look at the charts, because way back in March, there was this expectation that round about now inflation might be rising towards target. And that was only 7 months ago. That wasn't that long ago. And big picture-wise on the economy, a lot of stuff that we know now, we knew then. Nothing dramatically has changed if you zoom right out, and yet we've got this big spike in inflation now. It looks like I said yesterday, it looks like a child just drawn a massive great loop on top of the graph. But there are the factors that we all know about, and we've talked about so many times about this. We've got the gas price spike, we've got an oil price spike, we've got that combined with a little bit of a petrol panic that's allowed petrol stations to hoik their prices. We've got the HGV driver shortage causing supply issues in shops. We've had the supply issues around the world of various stuff, goods, computer chips, all these other things. It's talked about this kind of perfect storm that has suddenly dealt this inflation shock to everybody. The question is, will it go away? Now, if it does go away and we get back to 2.6% inflation in 2023, that's probably okay. We can handle that, right? We want a little bit of inflation. That's why we've got interest rates barely anything, and we printed all that money. We were trying to get some inflation. We were worried about deflation. It's if it sticks around. It's if it's that 4% next year and the year after. I mean, maybe that matters more than if it spikes higher. There was a scenario that was posited by the OBR in the report where this alternative scenario where it spikes higher and then takes longer to come down. And it's not the spiking higher bit that's the issue. It's actually the taking longer to come down. It said that, you know, two scenarios. One was a product market driven scenario, i.e. supply causes inflation. And the other one was a labor market pressure, i.e. people demand higher wages, the old wage price spiral that we used to get taught about in our economics textbooks, the dreaded wage price spiral. Actually, although that's dreaded, if you look at what the OBR is putting forwards, we all end up richer under the wage price spiral on average, whereas under the supply driven one, we don't end up doing quite so well either. So actually, I'll take the wage price spiral one. And then unemployment, finally, 4.9% for this year, down to 4.8% next year, 4.3% 2023, 4.2%, 4.2%, 4.2%. Unemployment, I think, has been one of the key things about the COVID recovery that has been a real positive, is that unemployment's not spiked as high as people thought it was going to be. And in fact, in many industries, there's an employment issue. They can't get the staff, which is what's leading through to this wage pressure that we've talked about. So... And if you look at what the OBR said in general about it, top line, they said, rebounding economy and tax rises fund larger post-pandemic state. The IFS has also pointed this out, that the measures that the budget and this one and have already been announced and so on, taxes are going up. Didn't go up yesterday, but we've already been told we're going up. Highest tax burden since the early 1950s, and they are planning to use that money to have a large increase in public spending, including all of this leveling up stuff. And the one thing I would say about them is the leveling up stuff isn't just total hot air and empty talk. They are chucking quite a lot of money at some of this stuff. And let's hope it pays off, because actually the country could do with a bit better economic balance.
Squishing two commentators together, a brown budget in a top hat and monocle.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's what was said. It was very difficult for the Labour Party to pick this one apart, because it could have come straight from Gordon Brown himself.
Right. Well, Lee, let's dig into some of that detail then. The Chancellor did promise to help working families. Simon's pointed out their cost of living crisis, that can we call it that, that's upon us. So did he deliver on that promise? He didn't reinstate the universal credit uplift, but we did get some news for those on the lowest incomes, a change to the taper, you'll explain how this will work, Lee, of universal credit, and a rise in the minimum wage as well we got. Plus, the public sector pay freeze is over. So, Lee, your thoughts about, well, what the Chancellor's promised to do to help working families, but let's start with the universal credit taper.
Yeah, so I mean, universal credit was obviously quite a hot topic ahead of this budget because of the removal of that £20 a week uplift that has been helping people out during the pandemic. And that being stripped away in a time when all of a sudden we're having inflation rising, energy bills going up, food prices going up, petrol costs going up, is going to put extra strain on probably the most vulnerable people in society. So there was that kind of issue of, well, you know, they've stripped that away, so what happens next? Now, talking about this taper yesterday in the budget, and actually this was a proper leak, because it only really came out just before the budget rather than being emailed to financial journalists over the weekend. So on a really basic level, it's going to help around about 2 million low-income families, but that leaves another 2 million who are out of work not having any kind of benefit whatsoever from this taper, because the taper is only comes into effect if you're working over a certain amount. So at the moment that taper is 63p, and it basically means so that
every pound you earn over it, you have every pound taken away. Yeah,
exactly. So every pound earned 63p, that's going to be reduced to 55p in December, and that could give, you know, a relatively
still big quite high.
It's still quite high, but it still rewards people for going into work. And there's always this kind of thing as well, that people that maybe are on Universal Credit and working part-time and perhaps feel like they could take on more work, but then they start to get penalised for taking on more work. So it's that kind of finding that balance of making sure that, you know, benefits and work and actually working go together. So while that's good, and that could be four-figure sort of difference for people, and also with the minimum wage as well going up to £9.50, the living wage, sorry, that's in one hand, you know, that is good news for low income earners and low income families. But a lot of critics will point to the other half of the universal credit claimants who, you know, are now not having that £20 you know, a week uplift. Yeah. And nothing is really,
but also helping. they're not paying income tax. So of course if you raise wages, there's more money going into the coffers, to be the cynical approach.
Exactly that, and actually that's the real nub of this budget, Georgie, really, isn't it? Is the fact that income tax and the national insurance hike from next April are what is going to bite a lot of workers, you know. And that's why I think it's the IFS saying next year, you know, in real terms, we're going to be worse off, basically, on the whole. Yeah. We're worse off because of those changes. And that's it's a fine balance. It's difficult to find that balance. But I think, you know, there was also pressure about, you know, VAT cuts on energy bills, for example, to help take the pressure off families that are going to struggle with the rises on energy bills. And that didn't come into play either, and then people have lost that £20 a week universal credit uplift. And then also, we won't go too far into the triple lock discussion, but that's going to save the Treasury quite a lot of money in the coming years, depending on what happens if they continue to use a double lock instead. And pensioners are going to also struggle with this as well, with this cost of living rise, especially over this winter. And I think that's what a lot of the critics, you know, should there have been a few more short-term measures to come in, you know, this is coming in December, this universal credit taper lowering, but should there have been other measures put into place into what is going to be quite a high inflationary environment in the next 6 months, possibly beyond, and it could be a very difficult winter for people. And you know, yeah, so...
Well, we did have speculation, didn't we, when there was mooting that the VAT would be cut on energy bills. It was a Labour proposal. The idea that the Chancellor wasn't very happy, very broad brush, because, of course, the wealthy would also benefit from that. We had sort of speculation that instead they'd go for perhaps extending, you know, the winter allowances that they've already got in place. But we didn't really get anything of that. And you're right to talk about the rise in the state pension. It's 3.1% this year. Otherwise, I think it would be 8.3%. Don't want to go too far in this, but if inflation is 4.4%, could go higher if the Bank of England, the noise is coming out of there to be believed, they will be losing money as well. So we spoke about the fact that they could have got about 500 extra a year, but that's probably even more now, given the fact that you've got those inflationary pressures. But Lee, what did he do then to address the cost of living crisis that seems to be looming? The fuel duty frozen, well, we got record highs over the weekend. Beer will be 3p cheaper. 2023, you have to wait for that one. But yeah, as you said, nothing about energy bills, nothing meaningful about childcare. We're hearing mortgage costs could be set to soar. Lee, it seems very different to the kind of tone that he was setting in the budget, which was, yeah, look at us, economy's doing so much better. And yet there seem a huge sway of the society, probably still recovering from COVID, if they are recovering from it. I don't mean the actual virus. I mean, financially speaking, there are a lot of people that are hammered over the last year and a half. Is there any cause for cheer for these people?
Well, I guess that's why Rachel Reeves said that the Chancellor was living in a parallel universe, right? But, you know, it all depends. And I always say this, Georgie, it does depend on your own circumstances. And, you know, there's always people that are doing better and people that are worse off depending on what's going on, right? And, you know, so take for example, there is going to be, I think, a bit of a panic about mortgage payments. You know, we've been in a scenario for quite a while now where we've had rock bottom mortgage rates. And if we start seeing base rate going up and we start seeing major lenders pricing that into mortgages and people are coming to the end of 2-year fixes, for example, you know, they might start seeing mortgage payments bump up. Now, again, that depends on your circumstances because your property value might have grown and you might have more loan to value in your property and you might be paying off less. So technically that might not be, you know, too much of a massive shock. And also these things, this will probably take time. I don't think we'll just see overnight all of a sudden, you know, mortgage rates going up a couple of percent. But it all does add on to that squeeze and it does all add on to that kind of worry and fear about things getting more expensive. Things like fuel duty freeze. Well, it's kind of a difficult one for the Chancellor, isn't it? Because it freezes fuel duty as we expect. But then we've got the COP26 this weekend, which it sort of flies in the face of that kind of eco movement. But at the same
time, with a short haul flight cut, surely.
Yeah, and that as well. But then also, you know, with the fuel duty thing, it's if you do pump it up, it's already quite a big percentage of what, you know, we pay at the pumps anyway. We're at record highs. And then it's almost like you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't type thing. There's always going to be critics for what you do. But yeah, the air passenger duty one was another kind of unusual move. I think that kind of took people back a bit, you know, about domestic flights. And I think the argument is to make it easier to fly, you know, to Scotland, Northern Ireland, for example. But yeah.
The only time I ever would fly in the UK is when I went to Belfast. All right, fair enough. And when I worked in Newcastle and I went up from Gap. And the reason I did that is because it was cheaper, a lot cheaper than getting the train.
Well, that's the argument, isn't it?
That way to Newcastle.
There is a new, you're in a sort of Newcastle accent then, George.
Do you know what? I'll give you a little story there, Lee, because I was a broadcaster in Newcastle. I went up there, and within a week, I kept saying Newcastle. And I got it bullied out of me. It's Newcastle. And I can't say Newcastle, Newcastle, Newcastle. Newcastle. Anyway, apologies to everyone from Newcastle.
Georgie, if you needed a wash and you weren't going to have a shower, what would you have?
What's he talking about?
If you needed a wash and you weren't going to have a shower.
Look, I'm going to have a bath. I'm going to walk in the grass and drink water from a glass, Simon. But it's still Newcastle. Lee.
Just checking.
Flights, yeah. I'm as southern as they come. It's fine. Lee.
Yeah, the whole argument is about, you know, the carbon emissions that, you know, if you fly from London to Newcastle or to Edinburgh or to Aberdeen, you know, it's far higher than taking the rail. But, you know, it's usually cheaper. But there is a new service that I think has launched in the last few weeks that's meant to be offering, you know, cheap alternative trains to these destinations. And it still takes 4 or 5 hours, whereas a flight takes far less than that. And what are business people likely to do? You know, so that it is.
Hey, can I just throw in there, look, with all the bump and all the getting there and all, it doesn't actually work out any quicker. You think it does because the actual transit time, as it were, for yourself is smaller, obviously, but it's not really when you add it up. I mean, maybe if you're going from Southampton to Inverness or something, well, that's slightly different. But anyway, I digress. Sorry, Lee. I'm passionate about this subject.
We're going too far,
having lived all over the UK.
We're going too far down the traffic rabbit hole, I think.
I know. Sorry. I'm gonna bring it back, Lee. I'm going to bring it back. I'm going to get Simon in this because I'm really curious. I mean, we thought we would get a few changes to tax or perhaps some rises, maybe not, because we'd, of course, had the national insurance hike that was going on, dividend tax as well. But I guess the really, is it clever, is it sneaky, is it, you know, is the freezing of so many tax bands for such a long time, is that where the money is coming from? More people getting dragged into those, and we've got a lot of them, in income tax, capital gains tax, inheritance tax rates, all frozen, I believe, till about 2026. Fiscal drag, explain it.
Fiscal drag involves dragging more people into the tax net by not raising the thresholds in line with potentially a number of things. You could raise them in line with inflation. You could raise them in line with wages, for example, if you did that for income tax or national insurance. You could raise them in line with house prices, perhaps, if you were going to do it for inheritance tax, because that makes up the bulk of most people's wealth. Maybe you could raise them in line with the stock market. Put it up, down, in line with the stock market. But it pulls more people into the net. it increases the tax take from certain taxes. There are a number of them where we've seen a massive growth in the tax take. Inheritance tax is definitely one of them. There are capital gains tax as well. That pulls a lot of people in. Income tax, the income tax threshold for higher earners, the 40%, went up a lot when it jumped all the way up to 50 to fulfill a promise that was made a long time ago by the government. The personal allowance rose by a lot, has risen by a lot under the Conservatives. They've really pushed that one up, and that takes people out of the tax net. We've not benefited so much on the national insurance front, I would say, probably. And that's the one that sneaks in and means that a lot of people pay more tax than they actually think. But yeah, it's an active strategy. It's an active strategy for all governments because it's an easy way of doing it. It's an easy way of having a little tax rise without actually having a tax rise.
Exactly. Simon, you've written about, could rates really reach 3.5%?
Yes. So this was the scenario that I was talking about earlier, whereby instead of inflation spiking up to 4.4% and then falling back down pretty swiftly, it spikes to 5.4%, and the Bank of England acts to raise interest rates. Now, the OBR cooked up this hypothetical scenario and then put it on page 75 of its report, or 69 of its report. I can't honestly remember which one it was, but it was kind of like a long way in the middle. But being journalists, we dug it out. There is something to remember. A, this is a hypothetical scenario. B, it's used a very crude rule for what the Bank of England would do. And it's got, you know, if inflation was X, then rates would be Y in order to try and tame it. And the reason why the Bank of England's putting up rates that high is to try and stop that inflation getting even higher. So it said it could get up to like 8% or something if they didn't do it. The question is, would the Bank of England actually raise interest rates to 3.5%? 3.5% isn't very high at all. It's very low, historically speaking. But that's only if you ignore the most recent history when it is very high compared to the rate that it is being, the interest rates have been since the financial crisis. We have embedded in our economy over the past decade and a bit a scenario where we are hooked on very low interest rates. Raising interest rates to 3.5% would almost inevitably have the consequence of completely crashing the economy. It would dramatically increase business and household borrowing costs. For those who have got floating interest rates, it would send them straight up. For those who've got fixed rates, it would mean that they would have some kind of serious bill shock once their deal ended. And actually, we saw this in the financial crisis and the credit crunch, when the issue wasn't that people necessarily couldn't get mortgages, it was the difference in the rate between what they were paying now and what they could potentially be paying. And the low loan to value mortgages got pulled. And so they ended up on standard variable rates that were much higher. And that had the effect of, you know, crashing the housing market, crunching the economy. Bank of England cut rates down to emergency levels. And we've been at emergency levels ever since. There are many economists out there who consider it unfeasible that the Bank of England is even going to get rates to 1%, right? So would it raise them to 3.5%? Seems unlikely, but you never know. These things could happen. And the one thing that we've all been baking into our assumptions about the post-COVID world and the money that's been thrown at everything, the furlough, the money printing, the huge wave of money that's been chucked at the problem all around the world, is that firstly, we could get away with it without causing major inflation because we got away with it after the financial crisis. But secondly, also, the interest rates will still stay low. And when we talk about markets getting freaked out by rising interest rates, the markets literally get freaked out by the idea that rates might get to 1% a bit quicker or 0.75% a bit quicker. So imagine what they do if they thought rates were going to go up to 3.5%. So there's a butterfly flapping its wings effect there, except it's a very, very big butterfly and its wings are very heavy. And that's a terrible metaphor. But I don't think that the Bank of England I don't think even if you did have that inflation spike up that high, the Bank of England would raise rates to 3.5%. There is another alternative scenario as well, though, that I mentioned at the bottom of my column, albeit this is a rather wishful thinking one. And that's this inflation spike swept in remarkably quickly. It wasn't expected by most people. A few people, and we've had articles actually on the site warning about how this could all lead to more inflation.
Yeah.
But it could just slip away as well. Could just vanish off. It might go away quickly. That might be the next surprise. The next surprise might not be that inflation spikes even higher and doesn't go and sticks around. The next surprise might be that everything just rights itself, and in a year's time, we're back to normal.
Well, I was going to ask you, because I heard another financial commentator suggest that the Bank of England had massively underestimated inflation. Do you think that's fair?
I think a lot of people have massively underestimated inflation. Yeah, certainly. I think they have. I would argue, though, in the scenario whereby inflation is being driven by all of those exterior scenarios that we mentioned earlier, raising interest rates isn't going to do that much good. I don't know what raising interest rates in the UK would do to deal with the energy price spike, for example. I think maybe actually having some more gas storage and not being quite so reliant on imported gas, that would have definitely done something to prevent it. But raising interest rates, you know, I'm not so sure. Vladimir Putin's going to go, oh, the Bank of England have stuck interest rates up by 0.25%. I better turn the taps back on and give the British some gas. It's not going to do anything about the rising oil price. It takes time to take effect, the old raising interest rates thing. So I don't know. Who knows?
I do like the idea, though, that Vladimir Putin sort of eagerly listening in. Perhaps on November the 4th, he will be on the Bank of England's website waiting for... Anyway,
apparently he was glued to the whole hour and 30 or hour and 15 of Rishi's speech yesterday.
Oh, I've no doubt. Oh. He was giggling along on all sorts, I imagine, to those hilarious jokes. Lee, we didn't get a huge amount about housing. I mean, we got promises to build hundreds of thousands of more affordable homes, but I think, to be fair, that's probably just a copy and paste job for every political party at every budget. One important area we did get was the issue of cladding. Explain.
Yeah, that's right, Georgie. Yeah, so it's going to be a 4% levy on developers who have profits over £25 million, which should raise £5 billion to start helping remedy this. The trouble is, the true bill...
How is it going to directly...
It's to remove the cladding that people find themselves in homes that they're trapped in, which has been really a real scandal in this country. And, you know, it's all from the Grenfell disaster to prevent that from happening again. Unfortunately, though, it doesn't look like this is going to be enough money to remedy all of that. And we are seeing examples in the last few months of people receiving six-figure bills for repair works in their blocks of flats, which, you know, it's just unacceptable.
It's a bloody scandal, Lee. I'm sorry. I'm just going to say it's an absolute scandal. If the situation is this is built on the fact that this was related to what happened at Grenfell and this cladding is dangerous and it needs to get removed, why hasn't it gone already?
Because it's expensive.
Yeah, that's fine, but this is people's lives. I'm sorry. I just can't get this.
I know it is, but it's finding the balance of who's going to pay for it. Because, yeah, no, I feel personally. Sorry. I feel incredibly sorry for people that are trapped in these unsellable homes. You know, and it's absolutely terrifying experience to be living in a flat which is on a fire watch around the clock and having to pay for that as well. And the answer, the simple solution you think would be, well, why can't it all just be remedied and sorted? Well, the thing is, you know, it can't really be paid for by the taxpayer because the bill's so high and it's not the taxpayer's fault. And then, you know, developers, if you start making them foot the bill, probably going to go bust. It's a kind of really difficult situation to iron out. And I guess this helps tackle some of the cost, but critics will argue that it's not enough to tackle the full cost of it all. But what a mess. I mean, just what an incredible mess.
Another area, Lee, you touched on it, but felt very conspicuous in its absence, was any green measures particularly, and more information about how we're going to pay for the current sort of ambitious targets that we've got. Instead, as you rightly pointed out, we've got a couple of measures, short-haul flight, duty cut, fuel duty freeze, and that seemed to sort of fly in the face of those ambitions, you know, mere days before COP26.
Well, I'm guessing that there's going to be announcements made at COP26. And also, I feel like we've been completely bombarded by measures in the last few weeks and months, Georgie. So I wasn't entirely surprised that the budget didn't go too far down the green route. I feel like March's budget added quite a lot of
You'd
greenness
had
to it.
enough, basically, Lee. You'd
Yeah, I
had
think,
plenty to go on with.
we all greened out, I think.
Yeah. All right. Fair enough. Pensions. Simon, we also got the promise that the government would fix a tax quirk that deprives low-paid workers of pension cash, which is paid to their better-off colleagues. But not until 2025. What is this about?
There's a flaw in the tax system whereby some poorly paid workers miss out on tax relief in their pension contributions, depending on the type of scheme that's operated by their employer. And it's something that they have no control over. Now, this is something we have covered in great detail before. Tanya has been pushing and pushing and pushing on this for a number of years. But to correct it, the government's going to make top-up payments directly to low-earning people who are saving into a pension scheme when they're missing out. It's not going to start until 2025 stroke 2026. So it will cost 25 million between 2025 and 2027. Treasury says an estimated 1.2 million individuals can benefit by an average of £53 a year. However, there are some low-paid workers who lose hundreds of pounds in tax relief every year. It's just a shame that we're making these people wait so long. It's like, why don't we just try and fix this now?
Yeah, indeed. So that's what was in it. Have I missed anything that you thought was that was notable and I've just callously left it out?
I don't think so. I think
Okay.
the universal credit thing, it was good. It does, as Lee said earlier, it doesn't help the people who aren't working, but it does make a real difference to the people who are. And it sort of puts universal credit back into the kind of position that it was originally envisaged as. Universal credit has always been slightly hobbled by there was an idea of how it was going to be, and then it was different when it was introduced. And I know that this has been, welcomed by people. I think the interesting thing about the pubs thing, and this comes from the landlord of my local pub. Well, actually, he owns a small brewery as well. A guy called Nick Farr. He owns a business called Farr Brew. He said he's already had people. He posted this on Facebook yesterday. That his analysis, right? Since the budget, I've already had five people ask me if their pint was going down by 3 pence. He said, I almost applaud the chippy nature of the question. The short answer is no. So it doesn't actually come in for some time.
Yeah.
And 3p reduction per pint on containers over 40 litres. He says that some of their craft stuff won't even qualify. By the time this comes in, with inflation being taken into account and everything, a keg of lager is projected to increase in cost by 15% over the next 6 months. So it may be the largest drop in duty for 50 years or whatever it was, but it's laughable to think it will actually change anything at all. No one will really reduce their price by 3p. It will just make a tiny contribution to the hugely rising costs in production and running a production facility for a pub. So the net result in 18 months' time will be about a 10p increase in the price of a pint
Yeah.
rather than 3p off of all of those things. Business rates, he said, that's really helped. That's a big thing, but it's only 1 year, so it doesn't help them so much. And that still there's weird problems with the system that mean they can pay way more for one pub than another pub. And he says, to give an example of that, his least profitable pub pays the most in business rates. The universal credit thing, he said, for some of his staff, he knows that will make a real difference. And I just think it's worth bearing in mind some of these things when we look at it and go, oh, well, this was great for such and such and everything like that. It's like the way that you delay and shift some of these things around is only when you actually look at how businesses and people are affected that you realize, oh, hang on a minute, that's maybe not quite as good as it sounds. So.
Podcast for the people, Simon. Podcast for the people. Just a feature there, based on what your pub landlord had told you. That's marvelous. You know, that's really getting to the people. Anyway, before I end this, we had loads of speculation. We had some real stuff that actually was announced in the budget, and we had lots of speculation about areas that could be ripe for hikes, changes, whatnot. Some of those were bringing pensions into inheritance tax, removing the higher rate tax relief on pensions, bringing capital gains more in line with the income tax rates, or perhaps lowering the threshold. One that garnered a lot of controversy was the student loan repayment level. Are, what a stupid question I'm about to ask, because, you know, because just because they're off the table now doesn't mean they're going to be off the table at all. But what do you reckon? I mean, the student loan repayment, a lot of people still think that that could, Lee, come in.
Yeah, the student loan one obviously did get a lot of traction just because of the sheer amount of people that that would hit. And already our higher education system is has become incredibly expensive compared to previous generations. So you can see why people would be worried about lowering that earning threshold to start paying back their student loan. But at the same time, there's a lot of people that have student loans that will never end up paying back the loan. So it's almost sort of catch 22 situation of how do you sort out what is really another fine mess, which is the student loan debacle. And whether it waits until another budget or whether that just happens between now and then, I don't think anything is off the table, George, yeah. If I'm being honest with you, not in this current environment. All sorts of things can be sort of put out and done. But I was actually really surprised. One of the first things I did yesterday when I was trawling through that document was look up student loans. I really didn't think there was going to be buried somewhere in there changes, but alas, there wasn't.
No, there was not. Or not alas, it's probably a good thing for students that that hasn't changed at the moment. Simon?
As Lee said, everything's on the table. It could all happen. It depends what happens next, though, doesn't it, really? If we're really emerging from the COVID crash, things are going to get better. Things keep getting better. The inflation spike is temporary. It just causes a little bit of a shock to the economy, and people move on. People's wages go up. You get a virtuous circle where people spend a bit more and everything like that. Then we should be all right. And maybe we don't need to do those things. And maybe we're just happy with the level of debt that we've got, and we're going to chip away at it, and we chalk that one up to dealing with a global pandemic. If things get worse again, though, then they are going to have to put the squeeze on. But the squeeze is already on. Rishi said that he actually wants to be lowering taxes and doesn't want to put them up anymore. But the squeeze is already on, so we shall see. I think it really depends. There's a lot hinging on this kind of late autumn and winter. And what happens, well, obviously with COVID and stuff, which hopefully nothing happens with that. Hopefully that's just like going away. But also with people's reaction to things like the cost of living squeeze and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's very easy to dent consumer confidence quite hard. And we rely quite a lot on consumer confidence for muddling through in this country.
All right, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team, any thoughts on the budget or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate and read the comments and find all podcasts past.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.